Thanks. I do want to say a word of thanks to everybody who was standing up as coming to one of these things again. Since you knew I would be here, I don't know whether to thank you or pity you or question your judgment or what, but it is good to see some familiar faces, and I'm especially grateful to Dale and to Amy for the invitation, to Emily for the invitation and for helping to create this worship environment. So it's really good to be back with all of you. And last year, one of the main things I heard, you know, I was like, well, who are these people and what are they doing? One of the main things I heard on Monday was, what you need to know about us is that we're really tired. We've just come through Christmas. It's 2 days after Epiphany. It's Monday. A lot of us have been traveling. And now you want us to think about what youth ministry is really for. And you want us to think about the shape of witness in the world today. And you want us to think about social theory and all that. So that sounds to me like a Psalm 131 kind of day. Will you pray the psalm with me? O Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. But I have calmed and quieted my soul. Like a weaned child with its mother, my soul is like the weaned child that is with me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time on and forevermore. Amen. I think that's a key thing to say, that all of these things that we're considering today, yeah, they're huge topics. They are larger and deeper than any of us, and yet they are not too great for us to consider, because they are exactly the things we're called to be about. And so we can, I think, consider them with a kind of courage, a kind of courage that our consideration won't be only in vain. I at least need that kind of courage because the first word to speak today is a word of confession. I was a pastor for 4 years, and I felt like I have some gifts for that work, and I had some severe limitations for that work. And the most severe place of my limitations was in youth ministry. That's where I just didn't know what to do. I knew I didn't want to be and didn't have the goods to be the alpha male of the group who made it cool to be for Jesus, right? But that was the only role model for youth ministry I had. So if I'm not going to be doing that, if I can't do that, even if I decide I want to do that, if that's not an option, what am I going to do? And what am I doing it for? What's the goal here? What are we trying to aim at? And then the hardest question for me was, how am I going to know if I'm doing it right? I mean, how am I going to measure what really good youth ministry would look like? Am I going to measure it by the integrity of my own witness? Well, what I did was show up, and I just kind of gave it to them hard and straight and let the numbers fall where they may. Or am I going to say, no, you got to pay attention to numbers, right? Let's take a look. But then what do you count? Do you count the kids who show up for youth group? Or do you count the kids who are baptized? Do you count the kids who go ahead and go on to confirmation, if that's in your tradition? Do you count the kids who come to the table? Do you count the ripple effects on families? What do you count? Or do you count the kids who 10 years later seem to have a deeper and stronger discipleship, so strong that they are transparent to the presence of Christ within them? If you decide numbers matter, what do you count? So those questions dogged me as a pastor. How do I do this? What am I trying to do when I do youth ministry? And then how would I know if I was doing it very well at all? Today, what I want to do is to start by considering what I think is the most powerful answer to that set of questions that's on the table right now. The most powerful answer, and I think it's really come of age in just the last 20 years, but the most powerful answer says, it begins with the doctrine of church. And it says that what the church is, is the interruption of time by God's own future. What the church is the very body of Christ come to life in this world. And the church then is like a little colony of heaven. The church is a gathering of resident aliens, people who are in this world but not of this world. The church is a Christian counterculture. If that's what the church is, then what youth group needs to be, it needs to be a formation of kids for this counterculture, maybe against the congregation that meets upstairs, right? Who are thoroughly co-opted by the world. You can't even tell the difference between what they do and Rotary meeting. So we got to really develop the youth group, maybe as the vanguard of the Christian counterculture. Or maybe they get it upstairs, and then we develop the youth group as training ground to take their place in that counterculture. But then what good youth ministry would look like? Maybe it looks like a cell in a little urban, depressed neighborhood. It could take many forms, but one way or another, youth ministry is forming people for counterculture, to be part of a Christian counterculture. So that would be what it's for, and how do you know if you're doing it right? Well, you know if you're doing it right if your kids look really different than everybody else. If they act differently, if they speak differently, if they think differently, if they buy different things, if they live in demonstrably different ways, difference then would become the marker of success. And what's witness in this context? Witness, the theme of this conference? Well, witness is something that you say, yeah, but witness would fundamentally be about something that we are. The church is the witness of God in the world. It's a foretaste of heaven. It's meant to be an anticipation of what all humanity might one day become. So witness is not as much speech as witness as being, simply being countercultural. Well, that's the most profound witness that we can have. Does that sound familiar? I mean, some of you are nodding. Have you heard this? Have you soaked this up? Have you seen it out there in various places? Okay. I want to develop it a little bit more, but mostly I'm presuming that you've got some familiarity with this model. It takes all kinds of forms. It takes hard right forms. It takes hard left forms. It takes every kind of form. That's part of the power of a countercultural kind of rhetoric, is that it just says it's counter to the dominant culture, but it doesn't say counter from which side. So you can insert a wide variety of kinds of culture and still remain a kind of countercultural witness. So I'm counting on you having some initial familiarity with that. And what I want to do over the next 2 days is to, today, read the culture and try to note the difficulty of a countercultural witness in a culture that loves, co-opts, and almost immediately commodifies all attempts at counterculture. So to think about the difficulty of a countercultural witness in a dominant culture that loves, co-opts, and almost immediately commodifies attempts at counterculture. I mean, how are you counter to this culture? How are you counter to a culture that loves being countered? How do you do that? That's what I want to do today. And then tomorrow, today I want to talk about how hard that is. And tomorrow I want to think about some faithful, largely ineffective tactics for doing that. The ineffectiveness actually is part of their power. Today I want to think about reading the culture. Tomorrow I want to think more theologically about how to witness in, from, with, and against this culture. Today, then, is about resident aliens, from the title of this lecture. And tomorrow, if you saw the title, is about bathing apes. So we'll see. Let me give you a handout to kind of keep track of what I'm trying to do. And if nothing else, this can be a scorecard so you can say, great, he's at three. There's only two to go. But you can kind of say, and I'll tell you in advance so that you won't be too dispirited. One takes the longest amount of time, and then it accelerates through three, four, and five. So they'll go faster. So I want to open up by listing for you some signs of the times, some signs of the times in the broader culture that I want to call an economy of cool, an economy of cool. An observation to start things off. This first observation is that an economy of cool erodes boundaries between dominant cultures and countercultures. An economy of cool, then, the world in which we live, this larger cultural matrix that we create and in which we swim, this is one that always is eroding the boundaries between dominant culture and counterculture. So I just want to start off with thinking of what that is, and then we're going to talk a little bit about how that works. So let me put it another way. We live in a time when the desire to be part of a counterculture is one of the deepest and most profitable desires of the dominant culture. We live in a time when there is, I want to argue, not much counter about counterculture. So let me give you an example. Skateboarding. Tony Hawk. He's an outsider, right? He's authentic. He is authentic. Tony Hawk, first skater to land a 900 in competition. Tony Hawk can really skate. And skateboarding, you know, is one of it, how skateboarding has done it. How has skateboarding stayed a kind of iconic outsider culture for, I don't know, 30 plus years, right? But it's pulled it off. It's very interesting. Tony Hawk video games last year outsold every other sports game over the last 4 years. Over $1 billion in revenue from Tony Hawk video games. $1 billion. He also has his own line of DVDs, clothing, skateboards. Net revenue to Tony Hawk last year from marketing his image, not from other things that he might do, but from marketing his image, $150 million. He was paid a $20 million signing bonus to stay under contract with his video game company through 2015. Why is Tony Hawk so valuable? Tony Hawk's so valuable because he anchors that kind of street cred, authentic outsider status, right? And he's got that. And then the video game company, or people who want to buy those video games, they want that, right? And they want to dress themselves, they want to adorn themselves with the trappings of Tony Hawk's outsider status, and they will pay big bucks, $65 a time, to get that kind of outsider status reflected through Tony Hawk. So if Tony Hawk is, if that's a $1 billion a year industry, is that a counterculture? Or is that a pretty big part of the dominant culture? Let me give you another example. Not to be personal here with any of you, but tattoos. 36% of people ages 18 to 25 and 40% of those between 26 and 40 have at least one tattoo. 36% of people 18 to 25, 40% of 26 to 40. Now, a tattoo, you know, that's hardcore. That's outsider, right? Well, except that almost half of the people under 40 have one. What's outsider culture? What's counterculture? What's dominant culture here? One of my friends in Atlanta, he said, well, you know, now that everybody's getting tattoos, the only real tattoo is a facial tattoo. That's outside. But facial tattoos are showing up more and more, right? I mean, is that way outside? We'll talk more about that in a little bit. But tattoos, with you have 40 million tattooed people in the U.S., right? This is also not a small industry. I couldn't get the dollar amounts on this, but 40 million people, what's a good tattoo cost? 200, what's a bad tattoo cost? $2 or 3 hours in English class with your pen, right? Let's say it's another $1 billion. Tattoos? Counterculture? Dominant culture? Okay, another example. Two words. Harley Davidson. That's enough of that. You know the drill, right? You hit 50. You remember when Marlon Brando rode one. Actually, he rode an Indian, but you think he rode a Harley. That's still got some cachet, some cool outsider culture on a Harley. Not anymore, if ever. Another example, the Che t-shirt, right? The Che Guevara t-shirt. I'm a radical, fight the power, rage against the machine, stick it to the man. We can accessorize that lifestyle for you. And it starts with the Che t-shirt. Or the Malcolm X headgear, or whatever. Icons of radicalism, icons of alterity, icons of outsider, icons of counterculture then become major, major cultural forces that generate industries around them. One of my favorite examples of this, it's not only in, it's easiest to see in commodities, it's really easy to see there, but it's also happening in real estate. And you can see it in any major metropolitan city in the country. You can see it in Nashville. How many are from Nashville? Okay, so you'll maybe get this reference, but you know, is Green Hills a cool place to live? Maybe. Is the Gulch a cool place to live? Yeah, because it's got that urban frisson, you know, it's outsider kind of thing. The interesting thing that's happened in New York City is that property values in Greenwich Village, right? This is ground zero for hipster outsiderdom. Greenwich Village, even if it's not anymore, property values there are now higher than they are in many cases on the Upper East Side, which was the bastion of the establishment. So the counterculture real estate is costing more than establishment real estate. Which of these is the establishment? Greenwich Village or the Upper East Side? Bond traders or designer architects? I just want to argue that in today's culture, the lines between counterculture and dominant culture are blurry, starting off kind of basic observation I want you to share with me. So let me dive then into a diagnosis of that. How did that happen? Why does that happen? How does that work? I want to argue that it happens because in late modern culture, which is where I want to say we are now, or in post-industrial culture, cool becomes a marker of status. Cool becomes, in many ways, the decisive marker of status. There have been other markers of status throughout history. It's hard to imagine that, right? But being well-born, being an aristocrat, having the right last name, that was a marker of status. It still is a marker of status, I think, in a place like Macon or something. You know, having those forms, it is, right? There are aristocracies, European and South Georgian, and everything in between. That's a kind of status. It's a minority status now, or it's a regional status. A much more powerful status is this status of cool. What's cool? Part of the power of cool is that it can take so many different forms. Cool means one thing in this neighborhood, it means another thing in this neighborhood, but if you want to get the commonality of cool, I would say, is that it has an appropriate distance from the mainstream. You can't have cool without a mainstream, right? You've got to have the square, the yuppie, the conformist, the dork. You have to have that point against which to define yourself, right? And then cool is measured by distance from that point. That's the way that status works. You have a mainstream culture, and then cool moves out from it. It defines itself by its distance from that. So let me bring it down to the ground and kind of say, this is what a competition for the status of cool looks like. So I say, well, I really like Backstreet Boys. And you say, well, I prefer Justin Timberlake's solo work. Well, that's pretty good, but really, Timbaland's beats do all the work. See, I'm moving out a little further now. Timbaland's a little more obscure, not quite as well known, a little further from the mainstream. And then you say, well, I prefer Timbaland's work with Maya over his work with Justin Timberlake. So, so you've leapfrogged me now, right? You've gone, I was with Timbaland and Timberlake, and now you're out a little bit further with Maya. And I say, well, actually, Timbaland, he sold out a long time ago. Now, Turf Talk, yeah, from the Bay Area, Turf Talk, that's cool. And you're like, oh, man, I've never heard of Turf Talk. He's got me. And then you say, oh, no, I have. Actually, I liked him better when he was called Killer Kane, back before he had his big label debut. Ching, checkmate, you win, right? Because Killer Kane is further out. So that competition of cool, the way that goes is, well, actually, I'm a little more alternative than you. No, I'm a little more alternative than you. No, I'm a little bit further out than you. I'm more counterculture than you. It's a status competition. It's a status competition that has a form or a structure that's not that different from a status competition in a 14th century Italian court or a status competition in a 1950s junior league. It's just a different kind of rule now, and the rule of cool is how far you are from some perceived mainstream. But I want you to see how many different forms this take. You can do it with Timbaland and Turf Talk, but you can also do it with country music, right? And in Nashville, this is the way this game goes. Wow, I really like Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift, yeah, well, Loretta Lynn. That's what a woman singing country sounds like. Well, I like old Loretta Lynn. Well, yeah, old Loretta Lynn is pretty good, but if you really want to get that old-timey sound, you got to go to Wilma Lee. Wilma Lee. You win. All right, so you've just gone further and further out. You can do it in hip-hop. You can do it in pop or whatever that is. You can do it in country. It's like this game of leapfrog. Do you see your kids playing this? A lot of you do. I think it crosses. One of the amazing things is that I think this cool dynamic, this status game, crosses class, race, and cultural groups in a way that few things in America do. This economy of cool, this status competition of cool, is one of the more pervasive things in our society. It's fascinating to me that it crosses all those lines and just changes form. You compete about different things. The mainstream looks like a different thing. And the status of being further out is so desirable that commodities that can mark you as being out there, that can mark you as far away from the mainstream, anything that can mark you as being out there becomes very valuable. If I can sell you something that marks you as out here, you'll pay a lot for that, right? You'll pay a lot for those special edition Chuck Taylors that not everybody gets to have. Or maybe you're like, yeah, Chuck Taylors. No, I'd pay a lot for special edition Bapestas, right? Or, you know, whatever it is. You find these iconic kind of products that you can sell. But what happens then with the economy of cool is that the dollars flow that way, the status flows that way, the prestige flows that way, and next thing you know, you have Tony Hawk, who's way out here, who's now making $1 billion, who's now himself a $1 billion industry. And so the flow of that, of the dollars, the flow of the power, the flow of the status, the flow of the prestige just completely undoes this. The idea of a dominant culture and a counterculture, because the counterculture quickly becomes a kind of dominant culture. So let's take this diagnosis then to a next level. I want to talk about cool as status marker, but then I want to say, now, how did we get to this point? And this is in some ways a parenthesis that is where, this is where he's really tipping into a university lecture. Ugh. But on the other hand, I think it's worth understanding to hang on to it. So how did this happen? I want to say there's two kind of parallel explanations. The first of them is that this cool dynamic, it has roots in 19th century bohemianism and everything, but it really, really takes off in the post-war era in America, right? That's when we invent the teenager. That's when you get that's when you get surfers, that's when you get bikers, that's when you get all the kind of icons of counterculture that still work more or less, right? And what happens in the war is you get this mass standardization of everything. You get canned Campbell's soup, right? You get GM cars. You get production on a mass and national scale. You get a standardization of things through increasingly national and international production that we hadn't seen before. So you get this mass standardization, and when the mass standardization kicks in, there's a reaction to that, a critical reaction to that, that says, I reject your mass standardization. I reject that whole consumer culture, and I'm going to be different from the mass. So part of it is a result of kind of post-war, post-World War II, massive standardized national markets and national products. The other thing that I think is driving this in part is in the deep economic shift of the last probably 30 years to where, especially in the developed world, in the United States and in Western Europe and in Japan, increasingly in Korea, the real source of wealth is no longer industrial production, right? We do less and less industrial production at all anymore. And yet these countries are still the wealthiest. So how can these countries be the wealthiest when we're no longer making cars here, when we're no longer making furniture here, we're no longer making anything here? What do we sell? What do we sell? We sell brands. We sell ideas. We sell images. We sell movies. We sell software. We sell, especially, brands. So what part of Nike is made in the U.S.? Not the shoe, but the attitude. Is the shoe worth anything? Nope. Is the attitude worth about 100% of the company? Yep. That's why the wealth stays mostly here, even though the industrial production is all outsourced. So call that a post-industrial kind of economy. Call it an economy of the sign. Call it a culture industry. Call it whatever, you know, pick your favorite kind of glib theorist term. Call it what you want, but that's where we are. And when we get in that kind of situation, when that's the source of wealth, when culture becomes the source of wealth, then the way you can generate, then the source of status becomes mastery of culture. Right? That's like being able to master industrial production. Now you can master culture. And how do you show that you've mastered culture? Well, when you understand so much of it, that you can say, well, Taylor Swift, no, Loretta Lynn. No, actually, I've mastered culture so much that I would say old Loretta Lynn. And I've mastered it so much that I'd say not even old Loretta Lynn, but Wilma Lee. You know, I'm going to just keep moving you out. I'm going to show you how much cultural connoisseurship I have. I'm going to show you how much education I have in the stuff of this world. That becomes real live kind of cultural capital. That becomes a real live source of wealth in a cultural economy. Does that make sense? I think that's how it's happening. I think it's happening because there's a reaction to mass standardization, and I think it's happening because the economy is increasingly built on cultural products, and so status is being able to demonstrate your mastery of cultural products. It's a culture of connoisseurship, and again, you see this everywhere. You see this with hip-hop kids on the corner who are, who will do it with music, who will do it with clothes, but you also see it in the most select suburbs of the United States, where it's, well, you like this kind of wine, well, I can do you better than that, because I've taken this course, and I know even more about wine. This culture of connoisseurship, this culture of moving away from the mainstream, it's everywhere. So a diagnosis. In late modern culture, cool becomes a marker of status. Let me then try to name for you a dynamic. It happens in three parts, and I've tried to list them for you there. The first of them is the erosion of an established dominant culture. The erosion of an established dominant culture. And this is what I was trying to get at with the Tony Hawk example, the way that because counterculture becomes the source of wealth, because counterculture becomes the source of status and in a way the source of cultural power, the power flows there, right? And it becomes the new sort of dominant culture. So you have an erosion of the boundary between what once was dominant and between what is now kind of ascendant. So an erosion between established and dominant culture. The second dynamic that I want to say happens is the absorption of resistance. The absorption of resistance. the Che t-shirt is a great example of that, right? Che Guevara, he's one of the great kind of anti-capitalist revolutionaries of the 20th century, great or infamous, depending on your perspective. We can make a t-shirt out of you, right? We can turn you into a commodity. Killing Che was one way to neutralize him, but it actually didn't work because it turned him into a martyr, right? And as a martyr, he had enormous power. Killing Che didn't work. Turning Che into a t-shirt, that neutralizes him. Killing Malcolm X didn't work. Turning Malcolm X into a brand. Gotcha. So this enormous power of a dominant culture to absorb resistance to it. I'll pile up some other examples in just a minute. So the erosion of an established dominant culture, or the erosion of boundaries between them, the absorption of resistance, and then the new dominance, a new dominance that is so thin because it can take any form, and it's almost invisible. I think that's part of the power of it, and this is why it can be so seductive and in many ways so damaging or so such a source of false consciousness for our young people because and for us, because we think, man, I am really outside now, right? And you're like, no. You're wearing your rage t-shirt, you know, you're not outside. You're a marketing niche, and actually a pretty well-defined one. And this culture has a nice, safe space for you to inhabit. And you can consume a lot of goods there, and we know exactly how to market to you. We know magazines for you. We've got websites for you. We've got it all. It's a well-prepared place, this little place of radical. And by the way, the place of Christian radical is similarly well-prepared. So this capacity, then, of the new dominance, we rarely see it. It becomes almost invisible. And the irony is we think we are resisting it mightily. We think we are outside of it, and yet we are more deeply tied to it than we've ever been. And then we don't even know it, so we can't resist it. So the dynamic that I'd give you is an erosion of the boundaries between established and insurgent culture, the absorption of resistance, and a thin, almost invisible dominance. Let me give you two examples. The first is not from the world of consumerism, and so it pushes us a little bit, but I think you'll still see the dynamic. No matter how you feel about the war in Iraq, you can still analyze, as a sociologist, the anti-war protests. Okay, the anti-war protests that broke out right when we were considering this. It used to be, there was a day when if you put 100,000 people on the Mall in Washington, people were shaking in their boots, right? What's going to happen? 100,000 people on the Mall. Is the government going down? We've got to address that. We have to answer 100,000 people on the Mall. Now you put 100,000 people on the Mall, you put 150,000 people on the Mall. Well, this is a highly ritualized event. It's a normal part of American democracy now. It's been nicely absorbed into the broader system. There's a whole protocol that the DC police have that includes public toilets and how you manage the crowds. It's a well-prepared for kind of event. And then it's over, people go home, and the policy rolls on. But more than that, in this anti-war protest, what happened more than that was that the anti-war protests themselves became an important justification for the war. Well, how did that happen? That happened because the day that the protesters were out there in such numbers, President Bush went on TV and he said, "See, this is the freedom that we have to defend. And this is the difference between us and our enemies." So the mere presence of these anti-war protesters is one of the main justifications that I would offer for going to war. That's about as quick and total an absorption of a countercultural effort as I can imagine. Let me give you another example, a little more lighthearted, unless you're like me and, well, no, it's it is more lighthearted for me, but indie rock is deadly serious, folks, you know. I mean, because we hang our identities on this kind of stuff. So in the 1960s, rock and roll was the official music of a counterculture. But over the 70s and 80s, you got, it became an industry. You got a bloated Mick Jagger. This is the counterculture? Oh, my gosh, no. So punk cultivated this reaction against it. Punk says, no, do it yourself. Forget your record label. And then in the wake of punk in the 80s, you had this enormous flourishing, right, of all these creative forms. And you had local labels like Hibtone in Athens, like Sub Pop in Seattle, SST in Minneapolis. And you could only get these, they didn't have distribution networks. You could only get it through mail. Some of you are nodding like, you know, this was it. And you could hear it on college radio, maybe if you lived in a really cool college town or whatever. So this great flourishing of indie rock. But now, what's indie rock? It's a genre, right? It's a genre. Indie is a style. So you have indie as a style, and then you have nu metal as a style, and you have radio stations that are indie, or are nu metal, or are jack, playing what we want to play, all of that stuff, except for they're all white, you know, that kind of thing, right? So indie then goes from being an insurgent outsider kind of thing to being a niche that's well integrated into Music Row. Right, and so what you do on Music Row is you buy Sub Pop or you buy one of these labels, so you get their cachet, and then you get their bands, you get their label, you get all of their outsider coolness, and you can sell a lot of records. And still, indie rockers are pretty sure they're countercultural. So that's what I mean about the erosion of boundaries, the absorption of resistance, and a new dominance that is very, very hard to see. Let me go then to some ironies. Ironies on the level of consumers. I've been giving you a lot of examples of the irony of on the level of consumers, that cool starts as a rejection of mainstream counterculture, but then we end up participating in counterculture. I want to say even more than that. If what really happens in a consumer culture is that it always needs to teach you that you need something more, right? It always needs to teach you that what you have is not good enough. Cool actually accelerates that because of the leapfrog way that cool works. So say, I need to buy Timbaland's CD with Maya to be cool. Well, then that suddenly is on the cover of Spin, so it's not cool anymore, right? So then I need to buy the next thing to move me out a little bit further, It's not just that cool becomes commodified, it's that cool accelerates the consumer process. Cool accelerates the consumer process because you always have to buy the next thing, because the next thing is the cool thing, because the mainstream catches up with you so, so fast. As consumers, if you want to defect from the market, we can help you accessorize that. If you want to live a life of radical Christian discipleship, you will be joining a well-defined and very lucrative marketing niche. That's as consumers. Let me give you an example of producers. I want to take people seriously as not only buyers, but also as workers, as makers. There's a really good book on this by a guy named Richard Lloyd. It's called Neo Bohemia, and it's a study of Wicker Park, a neighborhood in Chicago. Is anybody from Chicago? You know Wicker Park? So Wicker Park, it's artist land, right? And it has a grungy feel. It has to have a grungy feel in order to have its whole kind of bohemian thing. But what Richard Lloyd argues is that the people who live there say, yeah, we really want to reject the capitalist system, we want to reject the yuppies, we want to reject dominant society, and we want to live this kind of alternative life. But what he points out is that the way they live is actually exactly what late capitalism needs. Because what do? They concentrate themselves in one neighborhood. Well, that's handy. Easy labor market, right? Secondly, they valorize low wages because it's not cool to actually make a lot of money, right? So you valorize low wages so these design firms get people who will work for very little to generate a whole lot of money. They accept, they kind of even revel in the indeterminacy of life, so boom-bust cycles. You don't have to give them a 401k and job security, right? They'll come in, they'll come and go with the market cycle, which is what's happening in every other industry. But here you have people who actually like that. They don't organize as a union and resist it. They say, yeah, that's ensuring my street credibility. Thank you for laying me off. And then they say, well, I want to work in a job where I can express myself. And the design firms or the restaurants or the bars say, that's great. We want you to express yourself because that anchors our brand. And so then the yuppies that they loathe come down. They serve them plates of food or they serve them drinks. But it's a nice, healthy kind of economy. So Lloyd's argument is that it's not just as consumers that outsider countercultures get captured, but it's also as producers. And if you're like me, if you went into ministry in part because of a countercultural ideal, in part because you wanted to bear witness against, in many ways, this culture, that's an incredibly disturbing thing. As producers, and so that would be the last kind of transition to tomorrow, I would say even as witnesses. Even as witnesses, this dynamic works. And as we witness against this culture, we are often being co-opted by it. We're often legitimizing it even more. So now the speed picks up. Resident Aliens, then, I think is one sign of the times. Resident Aliens, a book by Stanley Hauerwas and Will Willimon. Has anybody read it? All right. I bet that's more than would raise their hands for any other book in theology that I would ask you about. It's almost without doubt the best-selling theological book of the last 20 years. I would say it is almost without doubt the most influential. I would also say that both of these two have moved on. Both Hauerwas and Willimon have moved on since that book. But that's the book that had the big impact. That's the book that I think is anchoring both of their impacts on the wider society, for better and for worse. So I'm not talking about Hauerwas and Willimon specifically and not talking about them today, but to say this book, Resident Aliens, Life in the Christian Colony. So here's the core argument of the book. If you haven't read it, it says, you've heard this argument, I guarantee you. The age of Christendom is over. The idea at that time when the church was part of the dominant culture, that's gone. And that's not all bad, because Christianity is a distinct way of life incompatible with the dominant culture, and the end of Christendom lets Christians give up the fantasy that by participating in the powers of this world, they will be able to transform the powers of this world. And so it calls Christians to focus, to pull back, and to focus on life in the Christian colony. This is the Resident Aliens vision that I was sketching at the beginning. It is, as Michael Budde, a disciple of this movement, puts it, to form a Christian counterculture. Now, this book has been a massive success. It's never been out of print. It's on the top 25,000 on Amazon. It's ahead even of the Anarchist Cookbook. It spawned a sequel, and it took two successful, important figures, and it launched them to the celebrity level, where Hauerwas is on the cover of Time, and Willimon is now a very important bishop. It also helped launch a network of institutions, Brazos Press. The identity of this press is closely linked to this movement. The Christian Century is increasingly echoing this kind of movement. And professors, myself not entirely excluded from this, across the country have built careers on this. This has been, this insurgent, outsider, countercultural thing has become a very important part of dominant culture Christianity. Now, I have to say that the appeal of this message has been differential. Hauerwas was one of my, across generations. It doesn't work with every generation. That's part of why it still kind of chugs along and still feels insurgent. Hauerwas once said, God is killing the mainline Protestant church. Thanks be to God. So I said that when I was a pastor. I said that to Lena Swires, 79-year-old, lifetime Lutheran who then became a Presbyterian. And she was really worrying about the numbers in the church. She's like, well, our congregation, we're doing okay, but what about the national numbers? There's just not going to be any Presbyterians in 20 years, and then there's not going to be any sensible people, and it's all just going to go to hell. It's going to be terrible. What are we going to do? And I said, well, Stanley Hauerwas says, the church isn't dying. God is killing the church. Thanks be to God. And Lena said, well, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And she meant it. That doesn't work with that older generation, that generation that wanted to build institutions. This ideal has very little appeal there. But from boomers on down, from the people who were the first modern teenagers to the people who are still playing off against and through the roles they invented, this stuff still has some power, still has some appeal. Church as counterculture? Does that mean I can be Christian and be cool? Wow. Counterculture? Really? I don't think so. It's not just the consumer aspect of this, but I want to say that the deep structure of our culture, the grammar of our culture is such that there is this place, this niche of counterculture that is so well prepared that when the church moves into that well-prepared, well-padded, already formed niche of counterculture and says, we too are a counterculture, when we do that, we're no more counterculture than Maya. We're no more countercultural than custom-made Chucks. We're part of that larger dynamic, part of that economy of cool that so prizes outsider status. So prizes the counterculture. So this can all be pretty abstract. Let me bring it down to the ground real concretely with two issues of witness, two questions of witness. Resident aliens in real life, two real stories. These are from my attempts to try to think about and try to live out what witness means in the world. A first one, when I was a pastor in Dundee, New York, one of the things I thought most intently that the church had to do was to break out of the consumer culture of shopping for churches, right? To break out of the thing where people go around and they say, hey, can you meet my needs? Can you meet the needs of our kids? Can you service us? Great, you'll be our church. Until, you know, you're not doing it as well as the Methodists. Sort of break out of that church shopping mode, not because, hey, you can't shop me, but because that's just not the right ecclesiology. Discipleship is not a project or a product that you can buy, right, that serves your needs. Discipleship is a transformation of your whole life, of your being. It places every claim on you. So no church shopping. So when people would come and say, hey, we'd like to join your church, I would say, do you already belong to a church? And they would say, well, yeah, actually, we're UCC, but we don't really like the pastor. And I'd say, well, then there's really, I'd strongly discourage you from joining our church. I think you shouldn't. I think you should go back to your church and help it be a sign of the kingdom of God in the world. They're like, yeah, we'd really like to join your church. And I'd say, no, I really, I'd give this whole spiel on shopping and discipleship and ecclesiology. And most of them actually would stay. And they would say, we really want to join your church, even more now. And so I was kind of, what do you do? I mean, eventually, do you just let them in or do you turn them away? I don't know. But I was talking over this with one of the really smart kids in our youth group. And I said, what we can't let happen is Dundee Presbyterian can't become a brand. And he just laughed. And he's like, everybody in town already knows. We're the brand for people who hate brands. And I was like, Adam had us nailed. Trying to resist that culture of shopping for churches, he got overwhelmed, co-opted, absorbed right into it, and I didn't even see it. I'll give you another example, and one probably that troubles me a lot more deeply. When I was a student pastor, I served my internship in Trenton, New Jersey, inner city Trenton, New Jersey. So I went to Princeton Seminary. I'm driving down to New Jersey. It's like leaving academic gothic Disney bubble, you know, and going down, no offense. and then going to Trenton. And our pastor, who was a very fine pastor in many ways, a very good pastor, she lived up in Princeton. And I can't say that I totally blame her, but she was commuting to her ministry, right? And the church was not, It just couldn't get any traction in this neighborhood. And after 2 years of working in that church, I just came to this conviction that you can't commute to ministry. You have to be where you're doing your ministry. You just have to be there. You have to share the everyday stuff of life. So I tried to do that when I lived in a rural area, to share the fact, you know, that the nearest movie theater is a 45-minute drive. Share, you know, just kind of immerse ourselves in all of that, which is not that big a deal, and was actually quite joyful. And then when Susan, my spouse, and I, when we moved to Atlanta, we're like in 1995, we're like, well, where or 1999, where should we live? And we thought, well, we're going to go to this urban church. We want to live in a neighborhood that is poor, that appalls our parents, that seems dangerous. You know, we want to live there because that's where our church is, that's where our ministry is, this is where Jesus would live. We want to live here. And so, what ended up happening from that? Well, realtors would see these white, inevitably professional-looking people strolling the streets, right? And they would say, wow, this neighborhood's in transition. And our church, then, what does our church do? Well, our church was and is a multiracial church. It's working through and across all kinds of racial lines and working with people in the neighborhood and saying, well, what's the issue in the neighborhood? Well, the issue is crime. So our church really works hard to help the people in our neighborhood, the people in our pews, there's not a strong division here, have safer lives, right? Well, what does that do? Well, that raises property values and accelerates the process of gentrification in the neighborhood. So that church, that deeply countercultural, multiracial, for the poor church in a rough neighborhood in Atlanta, what did it do? It made it a neighborhood where now only upper middle class, almost overwhelmingly white folks live. That powerful witness, countercultural, or just exactly the shock troops that the real estate agents needed? So, resident aliens in real life. How do you do a countercultural witness in a culture that loves to be countered? In a culture that says, will you make the other just safe enough so that we can market it, and then they can make it just a little more safe, and then we can market it just a little more widely? How do you do a countercultural witness in a culture like that, in a culture like this? Some quick clarifications. What I'm not talking about here, I hope it's been clear enough, but what I want to underline it, what I am not talking about here is about Christians adopting trappings of already existing counterculture. So I'm not talking about, like, what are they, the OC Supertones, right? Ska, Christian ska punk, right? Or where Christians, like, go find something that looks or feels alternative and then kind of put some Jesus in it or on it or something. So I'm not talking about Jim and Tammy Faye Baker's son, Jay, who now looks like he's trying out for Fugazi, right, and is trying to pull all the punk trappings onto himself. I don't necessarily think all that's all bad, not at all, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the church seeking out other countercultures and trying to deck itself out as if it were those countercultures. What I'm talking about is something that I think is much harder, an issue that cuts much closer to the bone for Christians, and that is what happens when the church is trying to be a churchy counterculture, an authentically ecclesial counterculture, a Christ-like counterculture, from our own resources, from within, our own convictions. What happens when we're trying to be that kind of counterculture in this dominant culture? Because we could give up trying on the costumes of various countercultures. But can we give up the work of bearing witness to a culture, of speaking words of prophecy and judgment and calling it to be better and different and other? I don't think so. So those things go to the core of our mission. How do you live out that mission in a culture like this one? And my argument is not that there is nothing outside the economy of cool, So I'm not saying that there is that this gets everything, that it's the Borg, that there is no resistance, that you should just surrender now, that it's impossible, that every attempt, every glorious attempt at being counter or other or anything else is going to immediately be captured, commodified, and sold back to you. I'm not saying that. I do think it happens a lot more than we would like to think. But I'm not, but it's almost, I really want to say, it's an ontological claim or a theological claim to say that there is no outside. And I'm convinced that saying there is no outside the economy of cool, that is a heresy. It's a profound theological error. For if nothing else is outside of the economy of cool, God is outside the economy of cool. And because God has not given up on this world, because God loves this world so much as to give God's own body for and in and through this world, there is an outside. There is an outside. There is something. But it'll take a different kind of self-consciousness, I think, a different kind of savvy in order to witness to it. So number five, instead of despair, wretched men and women that we are, who can deliver us from this body of death? Part of the rhetorical strategy of these 2 days was to create a crisis today, to leave you feeling like, doggone it, you know. So I hope you feel that way. But I also hope you don't. I want you to feel like I've got your number, or at least, you know, part of your bluff has been called, or that, like, you have some new self-consciousness about this. But maybe you'll talk back and say, let me call your bluff. And that would be good. But I don't want that to be total for the theological reasons that I said, and because I am convinced that if trying to be countercultural, if that quickly gets co-opted, despair, there's nothing less countercultural than despair in this culture, right? Despair. Despair has no traction at all, and despair, too, can be sold right back to you. Despair is not the option. Accepting this state of affairs, accepting the world the way it is, this, too, is not an option. So what are the options for youth ministers, for Christians more broadly, who care about witness? Okay, that's next time. Thanks a lot. And I don't know what our time is like, but is there time for like 5 minutes of questions? Questions, or if you have, there's nothing worse in something like this than when you have a point that you want to say, like you're just wrong and that was stupid. Don't feel like you have to turn that into a question. Like, is it true that you're wrong and that was all stupid? So if you have a point to make, just make your point, and we can talk about it. If you have a question, ask a question. If you have a declarative statement, declare. I'd love to hear from you. Please. A frontline piece on Merchants of Cool. Yeah. Sounds like a good thing to see, and maybe you can watch with free online. I think that there is a body of literature on the cool nature that is pretty well established, and I think the main more creative move of today's thing is just to say that attempts to be a Christian counterculture that don't even think they're trying to be cool, that might even want to be resisting cool, just fall into the same dialectic, and not only through consumerism. Yeah. Well, I was trying not to name names. The question is, how does this relate to emergence? I think emergent has definite tendencies in this direction, right? And that they need to be guarded against. And I basically think emergent has a lot of potential too. And so what I'd like is a self-conscious kind of corrective version of this that doesn't think that we're creating a Christian counterculture that is radically other to the society, but that understands its deep collusion with established orders. If it has that kind of self-consciousness, if it understands itself as at once justified and redeemed, well, then that's going to be a better and stronger movement. But yeah, I really worry about the church becoming, I worry about a fashion victim church. I worry about a church that has a new hot trend every however many years. And it's very hard to discern what's a hot trend and what is the deep renewing work of the Holy Spirit. There are deep renewing changes that are afoot that we need to say yes to. And there are also Teze, world music, liturgical renewal, emergent. I mean, just in or the way social issues change, right? Homelessness is big this year, then AIDS is big, then it's Africa, then it's back to homelessness. And this kind of whirl of issues, and the attraction of the issue is that it feels new, right? That lust for the new, I think, is something to resist. So I hope for a self-conscious emergent movement in the same way I hope for a self-conscious old-style organ churches. But I'd also say the whole traditional contemporary service, hey, contemporary service is dominant in the U.S. now. We just need to say that, right? That's at least elements of the contemporary service. That it's not insurgent anymore, for better or for worse. This is the establishment. Other things. Please.
I knew the world had changed when I heard the Grateful Dead in the grocery store.
Right. That's right. That's right. And to give you just an inkling of the little sign of hope that I want to give you, or a strategy of hope, because I do feel like I need to at least hint that there is something, and that I'm not going to just come in tomorrow and say, well, actually, there was nothing. Sorry. Okay, so what a lot of bands have done, they realize they can generate that kind of outsider cool, and then they can sell their songs for advertising. And so what some of them have started to do is say, you know, I think we'll just skip the whole label thing. I think we'll skip the whole music industry, and we'll support ourselves. We'll make our money by selling our songs to Apple or Volkswagen or any of the other brands that really, really need cool, edgy music right now. And hey, I'll sell my song, you can commodify it, but then that gets me, I make so much money from that that I'm free from the need to have a record label. So they understand the way in which they're being co-opted, and then they use their being co-opted in ways that set them, that also emancipate them. Right now, that's a complicated thing where they had to give up all pretense of purity, but it's also a savvy thing where they ended up doing some transformative and liberative kind of stuff. Does that make sense? All right. So yeah, it's everywhere, the dead in the grocery store, and Whole Foods. All right, other questions or comments or talk back? Well, thanks for listening, and I look forward to talking more tomorrow.